Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Yuri Herrera, whose new novel is Transmigration of Bodies, and Carrie Hamilton, who's the ambassador for his great-grandmother's book, Trials of the Earth, The True Story of a Pioneer Woman by Mary Mann Hamilton. And I'll review Lionel Shriver's The Mandibles, 2029 to 2047. Yuri Herrera is one of the brightest stars of contemporary Mexican fiction, and he is finding his many readers in translation as well. Yuri teaches at Tulane University. His first book, published in English, was Signs Preceding the End of the World, and now he's back with an unforgettable story called Transmigration of Bodies. Well, Yuri Herrera, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me.
Always. Now, this is a very noir story. I mean, the tale of a town ravaged by a plague, blood in the streets, and a man called the Redeemer. What an incredible figure.
Well, yeah, I have been thinking about this story for years. I wanted to tell a story that happened in the middle of an epidemic because I always think that what creates a character is the way in which every individual responds in the face of emergency, responds in the face of critical situations. And in an epidemic, what you have is a lot of people having to prove themselves in the face of fear, in the face of despair. So, well, that was the main thing for this story, that the atmosphere would create the characters and the atmosphere would create the story.
Well, it's so interesting that it's spooky. It's eerily prescient. You say you've been working on it for years, and I know you've been studying the drug wars. And here are all these headlines about the Zika virus this summer. It's just spooky. I mean, don't you feel that way in a way?
Well, it has happened to me with a couple of my books, actually. You know, my first book published in Spanish that is coming out next year in English, it was about a singer for a drug lord. And after I published that book, a lot of singers started getting killed because of what they were singing about some criminals in Mexico. And people were saying, like, what were you singing? And I think this happens with a lot of writers, not in the sense that you can see the future, but more in the sense that you can hear, that you listen to what is going on. And you use those elements in your stories. And I think for a lot of reasons, this kind of experience, the epidemics are becoming more and more frequent nowadays.
And more relatable, because the great thing about an epidemic as a plot device is that everyone is under duress or sees the possibility of duress. You know, it just opens the door to so much interaction, I think.
Yes, and also the epidemics is just a way of expressing something else about our times, which is that there is a lot of us all together in really small places, interacting sometimes in creative ways, sometimes in horrible ways with each other, and that we have to find ways to listen to each other. We have to find new ways to organize, to make decisions, and not just rely on force, not just rely on violence, which is something that happens when people are desperate. And, well, of course, an epidemic is one of those moments in which it's easy to just panic. But it's not the only one in our times. I think we are getting close to more and more of those situations.
I'm afraid so. Well, one of the things that I admire about your work so much is that you're able to take these noir situations and these dark, dark characters and give them this mythic overlay. There's something so stripped down and simple about the way you do this. It's amazing to me. It's very dreamlike. It stays with you the whole time you're reading it. It feels contemporary, but also timeless, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Well, thank you. One of the things that I try to do is to think of the protagonists of my stories as people that usually are not seen as protagonists of history with that capital H. And what I think is that people that are usually considered in the margins are people that are making history as much as the ones that are presented in the news. And that these people are telling stories that have been happening for a while, but that they are embodying them in the present day. Now, another thing that is important for me is poetry. You know, I think that every narration, every piece of fiction is also a poetic operation, because you're trying to find new ways of talking about timeless issues. So I'm glad that you say that, because in a sense, this is something that I try to do, that my stories can resonate beyond the space in which they were produced.
Now, it's so interesting to me that your books are not being published in the order in which they were written. That's a very unusual thing, I think. Does that matter to you?
It matters a little bit, but I was okay with it. My publisher in English, which is a British publisher called AOS and Other Stories, they already had decided that they wanted to publish the three novels. And they decided to start with Science Preceding the End of the World because they were thinking about a migration issue that is like the main thing in that novel as one of the issues that could be discussed in this moment in the English-speaking world. Well, I thought that it was okay. So they decided to start with the second one, then the third one, and the third to appear in English is going to be my first novel published in Spanish.
That's amazing. I can't wait. I hope it's not too long a wait, you know? I know this is just a shameless thing to say to an author, because you should always want more. But one of the things I love about these books is that they are short. You can read them in a single sitting. You can be incredibly enveloped in them and have this intense reading experience. Do you think that's something you're always going to do? Do you ever envision a big book for yourself?
Well, I fear my complete works are going to be not longer than 300 or 400 pages. And it's something that I don't really like. I envy the people that can write really long books. And sometimes when I have started a couple of these books, I have been convinced that it's going to be a longer book. But then I start kind of concentrating images and facts and stories in one single page. And this is something that happens to me very often. I don't know. Right now I'm working in short stories and I'm writing a historical narrative. And what I'm planning to do after this is now write a longer novel. But who knows, maybe that will end up becoming a short story as well.
Whenever I think of your work, I always think of this compressed power and elegance. It's really something I look forward to in a way.
And it's something that I try to do. I like the compression in the sense that what you are offering the reader, it's something that is really thought through, you know, that you are offering sentences in which you decided with very specific motives and reasons why you chose that adjective, why you chose that noun. And this is something that I have always said. If you are going to intervene the white sheet of paper, you have to have good reasons why you're doing that.
Absolutely. Now, you stuck with the same translator for these books, Lisa Dillman, and Science Preceding the End of the World won an award for Best Translated Book. So when you get an award like that, it's shared, isn't it?
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about how you've worked with her. She's at Emory University, right?
Yes, it's been a great, great experience. This prize made me really happy, especially because the main merit on this belongs to Lisa. Because, you know, I wrote the book in Spanish, but these are the words that mainly she chose for the English readership. It's a funny story how we met, actually. The rights for these books were bought before, like years ago, by another British publisher. And this publisher chose the translator, Lisa. She started doing the translations. She delivered two translations. And when the publishers read it, they said, this guy, meaning me, this guy is untranslatable. So they gave back the rights, because they thought that it was not publishable, that it was something that worked only in Spanish. And then AOS, my present publisher, they jumped in and they said, we want it. And I said, okay, but only if we keep the same translator, because I have been working with Lisa for a while. And this doesn't happen like this in every case, you know. Sometimes translators make a couple of questions at the beginning of the process and a couple of questions at the end, and that's it. With Lisa, I exchange emails daily for months. So we developed a very intense intellectual relationship. So I'm really happy about this. And beyond these three novels, whenever I have published a short story in English, I told them to contact Lisa, because now we are working together with every single text that I publish in English. So I think the merit is on her, but I'm proud that we have been working together also in certain specific moments.
Well, I'm very glad you finally became translatable. I mean, we're lucky for that.
Yeah.
Now, I'm so curious to know, your work is getting so well known. Your star is rising. You're at this moment in a writer's life. And I'm curious, what audience is more important to you? Your audience who reads you in Spanish, your audience who reads you in English? How do you feel about those kinds of versions of your work?
Well, I don't think that often about it, but since I write in Spanish, that's my first audience always. That's the voice in which I primarily exist in the world, you know. But I'm really happy that these books are also having a second life in different languages. And one thing that I always say about translation is that, of course, with translation, you lose things. You are losing a certain meaning. You're losing a certain sound, because the musicality of a book is a very important part of the book. You know, the sound of a text is also the meaning of the text. Not just the words bring meaning, but also you are gaining something else. You are gaining new nuances, new perspectives on your story. So I like to think of the original story as a sort of a matrix from which new meanings are created. And I'm really happy about it. The books are doing really well in English, at least in terms of reviews. They have been receiving very good praise. But also, the books are existing in very remote places. I mean, remote in terms of how far away I am from those places, like in Dutch, in Croatian, and maybe in Icelandic next year. So I'm really happy about it.
Well, it's so interesting to me because you go to such dark places in these books, Yuri. That must take some kind of toll on you as a writer.
Well, yeah, but sometimes it's better to share that toll with the reader, you know, instead of living with it yourself. A lot of people say that they are to make people happy. And I remember someone saying, no, it's not to make people happy, it's to share your unhappiness with people, you know, and to offer an opportunity to other people to maybe find similar experiences, similar ideas, similar emotions, and to articulate a way of overcoming them. You know, when you're writing about tough stuff, sometimes it's difficult, but also there is an enjoyable part of it. It's just trying to find a way to understand it, trying to find a way to get over the difficult things that happen in your life, or to accept them, to integrate them into your memory, into your morals, into what you are becoming. So I think for me, one of the principles of writing is just to precisely pick the difficult things and talk about them.
Well, and you do it so beautifully and so elegantly. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Susan.
We've been talking with Yuri Herrera, whose new book is Transmigration of Bodies. You can meet him Wednesday, July 20th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Yuri, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Every now now and then, books are rediscovered. Trials of the Earth, The True Story of a Pioneer Woman by Mary Mann Hamilton is just such a book. Hamilton, who lived from 1866 to 1936, recorded her memories of living in the Mississippi Delta when the land was still being cleared to make way for settlers. The manuscript was lost and found and published in 1993, and now is being published again. Cary Hamilton is the great-grandson of Mary Mann Hamilton, and he's here to tell us about her remarkable book. Cary Hamilton, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks, Susan. It's great for you to invite me to be on your show.
Now, one of the most remarkable things about Trials of the Earth is that a neighbor of your great-grandmother heard her tell stories and said, you need to write this if only for your kids and grandkids. And in 8 months, she'd written 150,000 words. Now, that's a work ethic, I think.
Yeah, it is. I think she certainly had all those stories in her head for so long. And Helen Davis, her neighbor, after talking to her, she just began to flow when she started writing her memoirs.
Well, one of the things that she chronicles in this book is a life of really hard work. And it sounds like she turned all that discipline to telling her story near the end of her life, which I think is so amazing. So tell us the story of how it came to be published.
Well, I was 15 when I first saw the book. I was at my grandmother's house, and there was a box on the kitchen table that had Mama's book written across it. And I asked my grandmother what it was about, and she goes, oh, that's your grandfather's mother's story that she wrote about settling the Mississippi Delta back in the 1880s. And I started flipping through the pages. Some of it was handwritten, some of it was typed, and I said, well, what happened to it? She said, well, she had a dream that she didn't want the book published. And that's why, and I know that in our family, the book was never published, even though in 1936, just prior to her death, that the book did go out to editors. And then after it didn't find an editor is when she had the dream that my great-grandfather came to her and said, I don't want the book published. She went back to the editor and said, don't publish the book. So our family kept to her wishes and didn't do anything to publish the book. And then fast forward to 1992, I was living in Oxford, Mississippi, and I was getting the newsletter from an independent bookstore there, Square Books, and there was an article in the newsletter about this book called Trials of the Earth, and it sounded like my great-grandmother's book. And I went down to the bookstore, which was just a block away, and there they were putting the books on the shelves, and the photograph of my great-grandmother stood out on the cover of the book. So I was shocked and amazed that the book had found its way to be published. And the way that happened was the editor of the book, who was in her late 90s, they found a copy of the book under her bed. And that book was presented to the University Press of Mississippi, and they published the book in 1992 without our family knowing it. The University Press had done a lovely job of publishing the book the first time, and they didn't do this intentionally, that they didn't give us the copyright in the beginning. I think it was more of that they wanted to get the book to press, and that was the easiest and fastest way to do it. So that's how the original publication came to be. Then, because the book was then copyrighted by the University Press of Mississippi, I pursued with my father getting the copyright back to our family, which we did. It took 20 years, but we finally got the copyright back, and then it was published in a small press a few years ago. And then from that, Little Brown, who passed on the book back in 1936, came to us and asked the book be published, and we made a deal with them, and Little Brown is now publishing the book beginning July 12th.
I know. I love that story of coming full circle. So let's talk a little bit about what's actually in this story. Trials of the Earth is such a perfect title because that is so much of what she endured and triumphed over, the struggle against nature itself, floods, wild animals, the dangers of logging, you name it.
Yeah, it is a perfect title. And the title for the book, Trials of the Earth, was created by Willie Morris, the famous writer of My Dog Skip and many other wonderful books that passed away years ago. But Trials of the Earth really definitely describes what her life was like, being taken from her home when she was really young. Then my great-grandfather met her, and then they got married, and then they moved from Arkansas over to the Mississippi Delta. That was, at that time, part of it was settled and part of it wasn't. In the area that she went to, no one had ever been. It was all just timber and swampland, and they lived in tents and had teams of horses and work crews clearing land, trying to make that land available for farming.
when she writes about my camp life, which she's such a good sport, I think I wouldn't have lasted a week. And family life itself was such a challenge then. She had many children, not all of whom survived, sadly, at a time when childbirth itself was very risky, and all the children contributed in terms of work to family life as well.
Mm-hmm. Out of 9 children, only 5 survived, and the 4 that died, you know, one was at childbirth, but the others had pretty tragic deaths that you read about in the book that will definitely bring tears to your eyes.
And your great-grandfather, Frank Hamilton, is a bit of a mystery still. He was certainly the love of her life, and she stuck with him through thick and thin.
Yes, she did. You know, he arrived on the doorstep of her family's boarding house in Arkansas, in a little town called Sedgwick. It's just north of Jonesboro. I think it's just a crossing of the road now. But they had moved down from Missouri, my great-grandmother's family, and they had a boarding house. And a very well-refined Englishman showed up at the boarding house and asked to be boarded. And Mary was just taken aback by him when he first walked up on the steps. And eventually they married, not long afterwards. And tragically, she lost her father and her mother. And she ended up running the boarding house for quite a while for the lumberman that worked in the town. It was a mill town, so they would have 100 people boarding at the house that she would run the boarding house at the age of 17.
Now, I think she had the makings of a feminist, truly. There's a moment when she's describing a church service, and she said, "Women can stand more work, more trouble, and more religion than men."
Yes, I think she definitely was. She was probably on the forefront of that movement.
So you've made this book an important part of your life, Carrie, for quite a while now. So tell us a bit about Mary's descendants and how they feel about it.
Well, I think everyone is thrilled. There were many of our descendants that didn't know about the book until it was published. Like I said, I learned about it when I was 15, but the rest of the family really didn't know anything about it. So it was only after that time that the word spread. In fact, my father and I had to do research, along with my brother, of finding all of the different heirs, because we couldn't accept the copyright of the book until there was an estate of Mary Hamilton. And she died in 36 without an estate. So we had to adjudicate that and go through all the legal processes. But tracking down all these different family members was quite difficult. One of our cousins ended up being governor of Mississippi, Ronnie Musgrove. And, you know, she's had some great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren that are spread all around the country, done pretty good things.
And you must know a lot about your family now that you didn't know before. It must have brought a lot of people together.
Oh, quite a bit. Yes, it has. And things that we had no idea who cousins were.
Ah, that's great. This would make anybody a genealogist, I think. We've been talking with Carrie Hamilton about his great-grandmother's amazing book, Trials of the Earth, The True Story of a Pioneer Woman by Mary Mann Hamilton. You can meet Carrie Thursday, July 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Pioneer, pioneer woman. History has forgotten your name, and who will remember the wild land? Your courage is all too tame.
It's an election year, so talk about the economy fills the nightly news. It's also a time of great financial uncertainty, so we worry about the future too. Here's a little glimpse into the American economy to come that will terrify you as well as make you laugh. It will also make you think about what you hold most dear. That's the neat trick of Lionel Shriver's new novel, The Mandevilles, A Family, 2029 to 2047. Like many American families, the Mandevilles are banking on an inheritance, but it vanishes rather quickly after the dollar crashes in 2029, followed by the great renunciation of debt. Savers get penalized while those in debt get off easy, and even your gold gets seized by the government. If you think the IRS is bad now, just wait a few years. Cantaloupe is topping out at $19.99, as are canned grapefruit sections, and self-medicating with your favorite wine is a pricey pleasure. Meat is hard to come by. Cabbage is about $20 a head. Yikes. And when a novel starts with, "Don't use clean water to wash your hands," it gets your attention. And culture? Well, that's vamoosed along with the daily newspaper and the hardcover book. Needless to say, those are gone, baby, gone. Nothing says old fuddy-duddy like a library of real books. The Mandibles, whose patriarch made his living as a literary agent, include university professors, therapists, homeless shelter managers, members of the middle class who felt reasonably secure until the world fell apart around them. Next thing you know, generations are living together, kids can't go to college, and family members are forced into uncomfortable alliances and Dickensian living conditions. And we see how money permeates and insulates every aspect of life, even though family members are loath to discuss it, to admit what they have and have not. And as you might expect from any family, not everyone behaves admirably. Most mysterious and wonderful to me is Enola Noli Mandible, best-selling author who's come home from France after anti-American harassment abroad. She settles in with Esteban and Florence and strikes up a friendship with her young great-nephew Willing, who's a keen observer of all things fiduciary. They are two of the most appealing characters in this novel. Late in the book, they have a truly honest exchange. Where else? In the kitchen. Noli tells Willing, young people want money to buy things, not only clothes and jewelry, but experience, thrills. Old people want money for one reason and one reason only, to feel safe. You can never have enough money to feel safe, he said gently. Money itself isn't safe. We should know. This inventive and often startling novel takes us places we might not always enjoy going. No one likes to imagine themselves in abject poverty. But these observations are so thought-provoking and so entertainingly delivered that they're almost a welcome relief from the headlines. If you're into using money as a bookmark, The Mandibles would be a perfect savings bank. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Bill Lofelm discusses and signs Let the Devil Out, Tuesday, July 19th and 6th at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Yuri Herrera, discusses and signs his new novel, Transmigration of Bodies, Wednesday, July 20th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Today's guest, Carrie Hamilton, discusses and signs his great-grandmother's book, Trials of the Earth, The True Story of a Pioneer Woman, Thursday, July 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Bob Thomas, director, Center for Environmental Communications at Loyola University, discusses changes in the environment of New Orleans from the beginning of the colony to the present, Thursday, July 21st at 6:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Tropical Abyss is a fundraiser for the programs of Antenna Art Gallery, Thursday, July 21st from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Antenna Gallery, 3718 St. Claude. Authors on hand will include cocktail historian Elizabeth Pierce, author of The French Quarter Drinking Companion, and Ryan Fertel, whose new book is The One True Barbecue, Fire, Smoke, and the Pitmasters Who Cook the Whole Hog. Author Night at the Knicks Library features Andy Reynolds, author of The Axe Boys Blues, and Zach Moore, author of To Dream of Dancing, Thursday, July 21st at 6:30 at the Knicks Library. Creative writing instructor John Foxjohn discusses writing concepts at the next meeting of the Southern Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America. That's 10 a.m. Saturday, July 23rd at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Not-So-YA Book Club discusses Fangirl by Rainbow Rowell, Monday, July 25th from 6 to 7 at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. And don't forget that the search for Waldo continues throughout Uptown New Orleans stores. You have until July 31st to find the popular children's book character and his dog, Woof. Pick up a passport to get stamped at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.